Les conférences du Collège de France.
Good evening, and welcome everyone. I'm really pleased tonight to be welcoming Professor Liam Murphy from New York University School of Law. Liam Murphy is the Herbert Peter Freund Professor of Philosophy and Law. He's been awarded numerous fellowships and prizes in the past, including the Columbia Society of Fellows in Humanities, Harvard Society of Fellows, and the National Humanities Center. And just a month ago, he was elected to become a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. So, as a philosopher of law, Liam Murphy specializes in legal philosophy, obviously, but also moral and political philosophy. And as you'll hear tonight, the connections between the three kinds of philosophy are really central to his work. Topics of his publications range from abstract questions in moral philosophy to very or more concrete issues of legal and economic policy, such as tax policy, on which he's written quite a lot. A central theme in Liam Murphy's work is that legal, moral, and political theory cannot or can never be pursued fruitfully independently of one another. They are, in fact, and we'll hear this today again, different dimensions of a single subject. And this is particularly evident in a book he published in 2014, which you may know, which is called What Makes Law, because that book's argument locates the traditional philosophical issue of the grounds of law, so the factors that determine the content of the law in force, within all sorts of broader issues of political theory. Much of his work has been in the field of private law theory, although, as I mentioned before, he's returned recently to tax policy, writing a new paper with Tom Nagel on wealth taxation. At the moment, Murphy's currently working on a new book project that concerns the connections and differences among the justifications of practices, including legal practices, and the moral requirements that apply to individuals, collectives of individuals, and states. His lecture today, and you can see the title here on the screen, is called The Legal Practice and the Responsibility of Individuals, and it will explore the questions of how we should understand the ethical tie between individuals and legal practices that are justified in terms of the social good produced by general compliance. So I'm extremely grateful, we are extremely grateful here at the Collège de France, Liam, for you accepting this invitation, and for strengthening, at the same time, the ties between the Collège de France and NYU. Your lecture is indeed the first lecture in a new series of lecture that inaugurates the new cooperation convention between our two institutions. So thank you so much for accepting our invitations. We're really thrilled to listen to you. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup, Professeur Besson. C'est un grand honneur et plaisir de présenter cette conférence au Collège de France. Mon seul regret est de ne pas pouvoir le faire en français. And those two sentences will convince you that I made the right choice. Nevertheless, I'm grateful to Professor Besson for the linguistic exception and even more so for the very kind invitation. And I'm grateful to all of you for coming. So to my lecture. Rousseau remarked in The Social Contract that individuals relate to the sovereign or state in two different ways. As citizens, they collectively make up the sovereign, but they are also subjects, subject to the laws of the state. And this duality of roles, the people both as governed and as in some sense responsible for governing, is not unique to a democratic account such as Rousseau's. In Hobbes's famous frontispiece to Leviathan, we see that the king is made up of a multitude of individuals. Despite his obsession with the need for the sovereign to have absolute power, Hobbes was well aware that coercive force from the state alone could not sustain a stable polity. The subjects need to accept the constitutional order from their own point of view, they need to be a bit like Rousseau's citizens. And this is my topic. Legal practices and the legal system or state as a whole require support and buy-in from individual subjects if they are to flourish. This evidently gives us individuals some kind of ethical responsibility for legal practices. But what is it exactly? And before I go on, I should point out that I use the word responsibility in this lecture more or less synonymously with duty or obligation. It's a forward-looking notion. I'm not talking about backward-looking responsibility we might think of when we're talking about criminal responsibility. Okay. So the legal practices I have in mind include all of the doctrinally distinct parts of private and public law, such as contracts, property, and the criminal law, but also at the limit, the entire legal system of some particular jurisdiction or of the international community. What is it for a legal practice to be justified? There are actually at least two importantly different questions of justification. The first, traditionally referred to as the question of legitimacy, is the question of whether coercive enforcement of the practice is morally permissible. This issue is usually posed for legal systems as a whole rather than discrete areas of law. Some philosophers have found a very tight connection between legitimacy and the moral responsibilities of individuals. I don't find these views particularly plausible, but I won't say any more about that here because my focus is not going to be legitimacy, but a different kind of justification of legal practices, which I will refer to as evaluative justification. Some of these distinctions are on the handout that I put together. I didn't want to put too much content on slides because I find that distracting, but some of the stuff is on the handout and you can look back if it's not clear what I'm saying, but you think maybe I said something about it earlier. So the evaluative, as opposed to the question of legitimacy, the evaluative question of justification asks whether the practice is a valuable one whose continued existence is a good thing. If the practice is thought to be valuable, its value might lie in the fact that it promotes justice or welfare or protects rights and enforces duties or something else. The evaluative question applies not just to legal orders as a whole, but also to discrete legal institutions, such as those of contract or property. So my question in this lecture, more precisely put, is that of the relationship between a positive evaluation of a legal practice and the moral responsibilities or duties or obligations of those subject to the practice. Now, it might be thought that the answer to this question is obvious. If it's desirable from the point of view of political morality that the practice continue, it seems immediately to follow that individuals should not try to undermine the practice and should at least to some extent support it where they're in a position to make a difference. Now that's surely right, but it leaves open further questions. In the first place, it's not obvious just how to understand the source, scope, or implications of this uncontroversial duty to support evaluatively justified legal practices. Secondly, these are normative practices. The practices are ones of complying with a normative order, a set of norms or rules. The rules of the normative order present themselves as giving duties to individuals. And we can trivially say, since the practices in question are legal practices, that legitimate and evaluatively justified legal practices give participants legal duties. But it is not at all obvious that these legal duties are at the same time moral duties, that they give us participants genuine reasons for action. So a crucial second question is whether they do. One more distinction before my topic is in proper focus. Justifications, by which I will from now on mean evaluative justifications, of legal practices divide into two main camps. which I will call the instrumental and the non-instrumental. The instrumental accounts see the practices as justified on account of their contributions to some good that is itself not necessarily reflected or even suggested in the rules, standards, or principles of the normative order that structures the practice. For example, one might, in the manner of John Rawls, justify contract and property law by looking to the role those institutions play in securing social and economic justice. These institutions are clearly part of what Rawls calls the basic structure of society, and Rawls's way to evaluate the basic structure of society is to see if it secures his two principles of justice. But of course, the rules of contract and property law say almost nothing about social and economic justice, and nothing at all about John Rawls's two principles. That's just one example of an instrumental account. A much simpler instrumental account would evaluate contract law, for example, by looking to its contribution to aggregate welfare, or better, perhaps, to aggregate weighted welfare, where improving the position of those worse off is given greater weight. These welfarist ideas are not reflected in the rules and concepts of the normative orders either. Now, an instrumental account could take other kinds of values to be relevant, values that seem more specific to the subject matter of the normative practice in question than justice or welfare do. As one example, perhaps one of the virtues of contract law is that it helps create, quote, a respectful community among moral agents, as one theorist has suggested. And I mention this possibility just to point out that it's important to remember that instrumentalist accounts are not limited in the range of values and considerations of political morality that they might appeal to in evaluating a legal practice. Instrumentalism should not be confused with reductionism, even if the best-known instrumentalist account, totally dominant in law schools in the United States, that of the economic analysis of law, is extremely reductive. But it's important that appealing to values that seem more directly and specifically related to the practice in question in an instrumentalist account is not the same thing as constraining one's evaluation to the surface level normative content of the relevant legal rules. To stay with the example just given, there's nothing about a respectful community among moral agents in the contract doctrine. And that's fine for an instrumental view. No instrumentalist account will treat the normative and conceptual structure of the normative order in question as constraining the kind of values that can be appealed to. Non-instrumental accounts, by contrast, do precisely aim to make moral sense of the internal normative structure of some area of law. So to stick with contracts, I always talk about contracts because it's the area I teach. To stick with contracts, one could hold that the point of contract law is to enforce parties' moral obligations to keep their promises. More plausibly, the point might be thought to be to vindicate the rights of promisees, promisee being the person to whom a promise was made and later broken. Enforcement of contracts through the award of money damages or injunctive relief can be seen as justified by considerations of corrective justice. The idea behind corrective justice is that the remedy does as good a job as possible in undoing the wrong done to the promisee, which is the violation of their right to performance. So non-instrumental accounts, such as corrective justice accounts, have it that the justification of the normative legal order turns on the fact that the legal rights and duties laid out in that order are real, that is, moral rights and duties. They are not, as the instrumentalist accounts all have it, merely legal rights and duties, merely legal rights and duties, that is, nominal rights and duties, the moral significance of which depends on further argument, and that will take an instrumental form. The plausibility of non-instrumentalism depends, therefore, on the plausibility of thinking that people have real rights and duties of the relevant kind. And this possibility depends, for a given legal order, on the plausibility of thinking that there are, in fact, natural, pre-institutional moral rights that match the legal rights. In my view, this is the case for many of the rights in criminal law, some parts of tort law, the law of civil responsibility, and in the case of many of the rights that are found in legal civil rights instruments. Where there are independent pre-institutional moral rights that a legal practice just aims to enforce, our question of the connection between the justification of the legal practice and the moral responsibility of the individuals is very easily answered. The practices are justified because they enforce real duties or protect real rights which subjects already have. I believe, however, though I can't defend this belief here, that much of private law, in particular the law of property and contract, cannot be justified non-instrumentally in this way because there are no natural pre-institutional or pre-practice contractual or proprietary rights. We must justify these legal practices by their good consequences. Instrumentalist justification is the only option. This makes the issue of responsibility of individuals with respect to the practices and their norms much more interesting and much more difficult. The final refinement of my topic for this lecture, then, is this. What is the relationship between a positive instrumentalist evaluation of a legal practice and the moral responsibilities of those subject to the practice? So let me restate where we are on the matter of the relationship between the justification, now limited to instrumental evaluative justification, of a legal practice and the moral responsibilities of individuals. As I said, if a legal practice is justified, then it seems obvious that individuals have some moral obligation not to harm the practice, and at least to protect it to some extent if they can. I noted that this leaves open what the source, scope, and implications of these duties towards the practice are. It also leaves open whether there is any ground for thinking that the justification of the practice and its normative order entails that the duties and obligations of the normative order are real moral rights, moral duties, and obligations. So I turn to the second of these issues first. Are the rules of legal practices moral rules if the legal practice is justified? Now, I've already stipulated, for the sake of my argument, that some legal practices, in particular those of property and contract, do not mirror independently existing pre-institutional moral rights and duties, because there aren't any. The question now is, do the rules of justified legal normative orders of this kind somehow become, by reason of that justification, moral rules? Does the justification of the normative order turn the rules of the normative order into moral rules with the same content? I can take it we can all agree that it doesn't immediately follow from the fact that good comes from general compliance with the norms of some practice, that those norms are moral norms. We need some argument to get us to that conclusion. It doesn't immediately follow, for example, from the fact that in breach of contract, a legal wrong is done to the promisee, that something morally wrong has been done. It would presumably be morally wrong to do that which will undermine the valuable practice of contract law, but run-of-the-mill breach of contract doesn't do that. Also, depending on the circumstances, in particular whether there's been reliance, It may be that breach was morally wrong for causing actual harm to the relying promisee. But reliance isn't always present. And the mere fact of breach of the legal duty does not mean that there has been a breach of a moral duty with the same content. Still, don't people have a general moral duty to comply with legal duties? So in the case of the duty, for example, not to assault someone, there are in effect two moral duties in play: the independent moral duty not to assault, and the moral duty to comply with the legal duty not to assault. In the case of contract, as stipulated, there is no independent moral duty to perform, but is there not still a moral duty to comply with the legal duty to perform? This is the challenge. I'm skeptical of a general pro tanto duty, moral duty to obey the law, as I'll explain shortly. But even apart from that, a general duty to obey the law wouldn't turn legal duties into moral duties with the same content. A general duty to obey the law would be grounded in some systemic consideration, turning on consent, fairness, treating others as equals, or some instrumental consideration of the good done in securing justice or welfare or other goods. None of these systemic arguments, or arguments with that look to the systemic effects of general compliance, could transform a legal duty that a promisor owes to a promisee into a moral duty owed to the promisee. In other words, the moral duty to obey the law, if there is one, is owed to everyone, or to the state, or to no one. The duty to perform contracts made is owed to one's promisee. So we're looking for a philosopher's stone that will transform the rights and duties that provide the normative structure of justified legal practices into moral rights and duties. One suggestion, appropriately magical in nature, is the following. It would be better if these conventional legal rights and duties were moral rights and duties. Therefore, they are moral rights and duties. Now, it's not impossible to make sense of the idea that it would be better, instrumentally speaking, if the duties of justified legal practices were moral duties. If people believe that they are morally required to comply, that will presumably increase compliance, which is good, because a practice can only bring about good outcomes if it's generally complied with. And perhaps, though only perhaps, if legal duties are in fact moral duties, people are more likely to believe that they are moral duties and therefore more likely to comply. So far, so good. But my fundamental question is, does the fact that it would be good if the legal duties were moral duties support the proposition that they are? Joseph Raz is a prominent philosopher who has made this kind of argument, specifically for what he called normative powers, such as the power to give yourself an obligation by making a promise. Raz's case for believing that we have the power to promise is that it is desirable or good for us to have the power to promise. I believe that the same kind of thinking underlies the moral theory known as rule consequentialism, which has it that we have the moral duties that it would be for the best for us to believe that we have. I think this way of thinking mistakenly likens moral theory to legislation. Legislation, or legislators, can make legal duties, and we hope that they will make the best they can think of. If they are thinking instrumentally, they will create the legal duties, the enforcement of which will make things go best by some standard. But legislators are actually making law, and in a functioning state, the law will be enforced. Their thinking is not in any way hypothetical. The moral theorist, who reasons in a similar way, seems to be inferring from the premise that it would be good if it were, to the conclusion that it is. And I just can't persuade myself that this is a valid inference. As with all my stage setting, there's more to be said here. What I'm attempting to do in this first half of the lecture is explain briefly why the simpler and more direct ways of linking the justification of legal practices to the responsibilities of individuals that have been proposed all strike me as unacceptable, leaving us with what I think is a profoundly important and difficult question. Now, just one more possibility to mention and put aside before turning to the difficult question. Herbert Hart introduced the idea of acceptance of a rule or norm. In Hart's sense, I accept a legal rule just in case I treat it as providing me with a reason for action. I needn't believe that that reason is a moral reason. I might accept norms out of self-interest or a desire to conform. Now, it's fair to say that the norms of contract law are generally accepted in this sense in most places. Now, one might argue that though it doesn't immediately follow from the fact that a normative practice does good, that the rules of that practice are moral rules, nevertheless, when to that fact is added the further fact of general acceptance of the rules, the conclusion that they are moral rules does follow. So the thought is neither general acceptance alone nor beneficial consequences alone will transform the legal rules into moral rules, but the combination does. General acceptance of a harmful practice, such as some caste hierarchy, can't give the rules of that practice moral force, but the thought is general acceptance of an evaluatively justified practice can do this. One way to arrive at this position is via a certain kind of skepticism about objective morality. All we have are conventions, the thought might go. And as long as the convention is good, nothing more is needed to establish that the conventional rules are moral rules. Looking for anything beyond conventions that are good is some philosopher's pipe dream. This position, however, is incoherent since it appeals to an objective evaluation of the convention. And if it's grounded in skepticism about objective morality, it has no right to do that. To be consistent, the skeptical all we have are conventions position would have to give the same moral force to the norms of the caste hierarchy as to, say, contract law. So I'm going to leave that aside. But there is another way to understand the significance of the fact of general acceptance of the rules of a practice, and it's in terms of fairness. Isn't it unfair not to comply with the norms of a beneficial practice if others are generally complying? Wouldn't non-compliance amount to free riding? I think this is a serious argument, but if it is successful, it doesn't establish that the rules of the practice are moral rules. Like the argument from the duty to obey, it would establish only that it would be wrong not to comply with them. Okay, so there are no doubt other ways of arguing that the rules of justified legal practices are themselves moral rules. But I want to end discussion of the idea that the rights and duties of justified legal practices just are moral rights and duties by pointing out a peculiar implication of it. It is that if this position is correct, our moral rights and duties can be changed by legislation. Some may find that an acceptable conclusion, but I don't. I think a much more palatable claim is the much weaker one that it is always morally required to comply with legal rules if they are part of evaluatively justified practices. It's always morally wrong not to fulfill one's legal duty or respect others' legal rights. On such a position, change in the legal order of rights and obligations doesn't change our moral rights and obligations. The standard moral duty to comply with the rules of justified legal practices would be unchanged. Its application would just be different. This, as I say, is a much more palatable position. But my next question is, do we actually have a standing moral duty to comply with the rules of justified legal practices? As I've said, if a legal practice is justified, then it seems obvious that individuals have some moral obligation not to harm the practice and also to protect it, at least to some extent. Philosophers usually refer to this as political obligation, and I will from now on often use that shorthand too. It just should be remembered that while political obligation is usually thought of as applying to the state or the legal system as a whole, I'm also interested in the obligations we have towards justified discrete legal practices such as contract law. Now, as noted, the obvious fact that we have political obligation with some content leaves open what the source, scope, and implications of that obligation are. If we investigate each of these three dimensions, we may be able to answer the question whether it is an implication of political obligation that we have a standing moral duty to comply with the rules of justified legal practices. Let's start with the most basic question, that of source. Once again, in order to arrive at the difficult question that interests me, I'm going to have to set aside several possibilities with that argument, though the arguments are all well rehearsed in the literature and I'm happy to talk about them. So we'll set aside arguments grounding political obligation in actual consent, in joint commitment, associative obligations, considerations of fair play, though I will return to fair play in a moment. I'm going to limit myself to the most natural kind of argument concerning the responsibilities of individuals with respect to instrumentally justified legal practices, which is that we, each of us, are required to promote the very same good things that the practice promotes and in virtue of which it is justified. As we saw, Rawls positively evaluates legal practices if they are part of a set of institutions that secure justice. It's not surprising, then, that his name for the duty individuals have with respect to those practices is the natural duty of justice. Similarly, a utilitarian who justifies practices in virtue of their contribution to general welfare understands political obligation as a duty to promote the very same thing. Now, I've left open the range of values that an instrumental justification of legal practices might appeal to. What they all have in common, however, is that practices are justified as a means to some set of goods. And so the entirely general label for the ethical tie between legal practices thus justified and the ethical responsibilities of individuals is a duty of beneficence, that is, a duty to do good. On this way of understanding the matter, Rawls's natural duty of justice is a duty of beneficence, where the good in view is that of social and economic justice. Though the most natural source of political obligation with respect to instrumentally justified legal practices is a duty of beneficence, this approach faces striking difficulties when it comes to scope and implications, and the remainder of my remarks explores those difficulties. So let's turn now to scope and the question of whether the duty of beneficence implies a standing duty to comply with the rules of justified practices. The answer surely depends on who you are. Take the President of the United States. Noncompliance by this high state official, we know, in theory and currently in daily practice, can do catastrophic damage to a legal order. The same goes to somewhat lesser extents for other high state officials. In all of the three branches of government. But let's stick with the president for now. In the case of the president, noncompliance is both very public and almost entirely immune to correction through enforcement mechanisms. It's tantamount to an attack on the legal system as a whole. It's true that particular acts of noncompliance by a president may sometimes do more good than harm in the case of genuine emergencies, for example, but these will truly be exceptional cases, and a general practical orientation of indifference to legal rules is a disaster. Similarly strong implications for compliance apply to states under international law. With relatively few legal subjects, non-compliance by any one of them can do harm, and non-compliance by the most powerful states can do very great harm to the practice. Below the level of the president or the state, consider now publicly known institutional actors, such as prominent law firms or universities. This is not a random example. Here, too, non-compliance can be corrosive because publicly known, and the duty of beneficence will counsel more exact compliance with the law. It will also, and this is what's of very great contemporary importance in the US at the moment, it will also counsel refusal to submit to unlawful pressure from the state without a legal fight. The duty on prominent institutional actors to protect the legal order implies the duty to speak up and lawfully resist acts of official lawlessness. But now, consider an anonymous private citizen. Does my non-compliance almost always do more harm than good? Not at all. In fact, it commonly does no harm at all. Take, again, the case of breach of a purely executory contract. That's one where there's been no reliance on either side. The breach does no harm to the promisee, and it does no harm to the generally beneficial legal order of contract law. Or consider breach of some mala prohibita regulation, criminal regulation, general compliance with which does good, but a single compliance, again, won't do any harm. It's sometimes said that we should remember that non-compliance could set a bad example and lead others to fail to comply and so to harm. But unless you're the Archbishop of Canterbury or Taylor Swift, any single private individual is just not going to have these kinds of flow-on effects when they fail to comply. Now, as a reminder and to avoid misunderstanding, some legal rules enforce independently existing moral obligations. So non-compliance with those legal rules will be wrong for other reasons. Equally, as I've noted, sometimes non-compliance with a legal rule will harm particular others in a way that wouldn't have been possible without the rule, and so it will be wrong for that reason. But non-compliance by private individuals with legal duties that do not enforce independent moral duties will typically not cause any kind of systemic harm. It will not harm the justified practice in question. So does that mean that private individuals can simply ignore the law and tend only to their moral duties, including their duties not to harm others? Does it mean that there is no duty at all to comply with legal rules and the scope of political obligation is limited to a negative duty, not to go about actively undermining the practice, for example, by bribing judges? That just seems implausible, and for a very simple reason. If enough of us fail to comply, the practice will collapse or be sufficiently harmed that the good effects that justify it will no longer be achieved. We together would seem to be acting wrongly if we together stop complying. Surely this fact must have some implication for the responsibilities of individuals. Yet how are we to square that evident truth with the equally evident fact that any one of us ceasing to comply will have no effect on the health of the practice? This is one of the central puzzles raised by a beneficence-based counter-political obligation. We can call it the problem of the one and the many. The issue of the one and the many crops up in many other contexts, most notably and pressingly in environmental contexts. If every human on the planet complied with some expert recommendations concerning what needs to be done with respect to greenhouse gas emissions, our prospects would be much better. But each person feels vividly that their own impact is minimal to non-existent. One conclusion to draw is that of Walter Sinnott Armstrong, who wrote, quote, "It is better to enjoy your Sunday driving while working to change the law so as to make it illegal for you to enjoy your Sunday driving." I assume he means make it illegal for you to drive, not illegal for you to enjoy. There's nothing inherently objectionable about the coercive enforcement of behaviour that's not morally required. That's the structure of Armstrong's example. You're morally permitted as an individual to drive, but the state is also morally permitted to prohibit you from driving. And there's nothing, as I say, objectionable about coercive enforcement of behaviour that's not morally required. It certainly applies to compliance with law. The legitimacy of enforcement doesn't depend on there being standing moral obligations to comply with the law. But there are limits to how much can be done with enforcement. As I've said, nothing can force the US president to comply with law. And even for the rest of us, general compliance can't realistically be the result solely of coercive enforcement. Voluntary compliance by very many people is essential for a stable legal order. And as I've already said, even Hobbes was aware of this. But even aside from that, there's a fundamental problem with the suggestion that each should go ahead and fail to comply, hoping somehow that all will be forced to comply by the government. Were we all to fail to comply, that would have very bad effects. Again, could that fact really have nothing to do with the question of how each should reason in their own case? Now, it's tempting at this point to think that we've just seen that we can't give an account of individual duties of compliance by appeal to beneficence only. Beneficence can explain why we should not work actively to undermine the system, but on its own, it's not going to give a satisfactory account of case-by-case compliance by individuals. Of the various deontological accounts of a duty to comply that I set aside to focus on beneficence, an appeal to fairness seems especially tempting in the context of the problem of the one and the many. Surely what's wrong with each thinking that it is great if others comply, but there's no reason for me to, is that it amounts to free riding, taking the benefits of cooperation while refusing to shoulder the burdens. Or perhaps better put, the issue here is not so much voluntary acceptance of benefits, but of leaving to others what we all have an obligation to do, shirking our responsibilities, in other words. There's plausibility to this line of thought. The objection could be put like this. Here we all are complying so that the practice doesn't collapse. It's true that your non-compliance doesn't in itself make any difference, but it's still unfair of you to make an exception for yourself when you know that it would be a disaster if we all did. Or perhaps, rather than appealing to fairness, we should say that making an exception for yourself shows a lack of solidarity with respect to a goal that, by hypothesis, we all share. And this certainly rings true, and it seems to me to be part of the truth. But I believe that it can't be the whole of the truth. Suppose a situation of increasing non-compliance and a threat to the stability or effectiveness of justified legal practices. Would our main moral thought be that there's a breakdown in solidarity? Or suppose a situation where a valuable practice has fully broken down and no one is complying anymore. That's a bad situation, but there's no issue of solidarity or unfairness. The problem is that something good has been lost. The practices are justified by their good effects. We are assuming that people have obligations of beneficence. Is there really no way of connecting these two dots? Now, the solution to the problem of the one and the many, I believe, after thinking about this problem for about 40 years, I believe, for the time being, is to acknowledge two perspectives on our actions and their effects. There are the individual effects, the effects of my acts considered on their own. These effects, in the case of compliance with the rules of legal practices by private individuals, are morally insignificant or non-existent. And then there are the effects of the acts of groups of which I am a part. I should consider not just the effects of what I do as an individual, but also those of what I do together with others. Though he later changed his mind, I believe that Derek Parfit was right to say, even if an act harms no one, this act may be wrong because it is one of a set of acts that together harm other people. Now, Parfit, in his book Reasons and Persons, gave an example to illustrate this thought, a very famous example of the so-called harmless torturers. In this example, 1,000 torturers each press a button that causes no perceptible difference to the pain level of each of 1,000 victims, but the collective effect of the 1,000 torturers each pressing their button is to cause severe pain in the victims. If we assume that each torturer causes no harm by pressing their button and so is not for that reason acting wrongly, each does no harm on their own, but each does act wrongly for causing harm together with the others. Now, yes, it's helpful to note that in cases like this, cases, that is, where we together cause harm, but each act considered in isolation does not, in cases like this, it makes a moral difference whether I act with nature or with others. Compare two cases concerning air pollution and automobiles. In both cases, it's true that no individual driver causes the particulate level in the atmosphere to increase enough to count as harmful. But the cases, my imaginary cases, differ in a crucial respect. In one case, 1,000 drivers together cause harmful particulate levels. In the other case, only one person drives, but the particulate level is the same as in the first case because of a forest fire or bushfire. On the view I'm defending, each driver acts wrongly in the first case, where they act together with others, but not in the second, where they act together with nature. It's also helpful to note that these kinds of cases involve an intransitive relation. A transitive relation is one like is taller than. If B is taller than A and C is taller than B, C is taller than A. In the harmless torturous case, the relation is no worse than with respect to pain is intransitive. If it were transitive, then if the pain is no worse after one button is pressed and no worse after a second pressing, it would also be no worse after a third, and so on and so forth. But that's not how it works. If we imagine each torturer pressing their button in turn, then after each pressing, the situation for the victims is no worse than it was before that pressing. However, after some number of pressings, say 10, the pain is worse than it was 10 pressings ago, though not worse than it was one pressing ago. This means that no worse than is here intransitive. And this is similar to the intransitivity of is or looks the same color as we move in small steps across a color gradient where the shade changes very gradually. I'm afraid on that slide that shade doesn't seem to be changing at all, but it's supposed to be a darker red on the right and a lighter red on the left. If you make very small hops, you'll say same color, same color, same color, but then after a certain number of hops, you look back at where you started and say, well, it's different from that color. That means is the same color as is intransitive. Now, the idea of each doing nothing wrong considered as an individual, yet each acting wrongly together with others, is, I readily admit, very puzzling. It's tempting to resist it by saying that if what I do doesn't make any difference, I just can't be part of a group whose acts together do. If one torturer fails to press the button, that won't reduce the harm. So in what sense could they be part of a group that causes harm? Zero multiplied by any number still gets you to zero. But of course, we know that this line of thought must be mistaken, because everyone can reason in that way, and yet the fact remains that there is a group that causes harm. To see what's going on here, we just have to note that if enough others press rather than not press their buttons, that will make a difference. As against any baseline number of pressings, there is a minimal number of additional pressings that together would make the pain worse. Let's suppose the number is 10. So each torturer considering whether or not to press their button is a member of many possible groups of 10. If all the members of one of those groups of 10 might either press or not press, then each torturer has a reason not to press, lest they be part of a group that together makes things worse. So where does all that stuff about Parfit's example leave me as I think about whether I should perform my contract just because performance is required by valuable legal practice? I'm part of many groups large enough that non-compliance rather than compliance by all the group's members would harm the practice. But non-compliance by all the members of any one of these groups doesn't currently seem to be very likely. It seems unlikely that if I fail to comply, I'll be part of a group that together does harm. This is in part because legal enforcement of contract and the role of reputational sanctions are generally sufficient to motivate or compel compliance. The same goes for mala prohibita criminal offences and many other examples. But in a different context, where enforcement and informal sanctions are not as effective, it may well be very different. Different in that we will have to rely more on moral motivations to secure compliance, and it may become quite likely that a group of people large enough to harm the practice will switch from compliance to non-compliance. In that situation, I would have reason to comply, lest I be part of a group whose non-compliance harms the practice. Okay, so much for the problem of the one and the many as it applies to political obligation grounded in beneficence. I turn now to some implications of understanding political obligation in this way. Most dramatically, if we have responsibilities with respect to legal practices because of the good they do, we have to accept that we have quite general responsibility to make things go better on whatever account of better you prefer. It would be odd to care about legal practices as a means to good things, but not care about other ways of making things better, such as giving up time and money, working to make legal and other social practices better, and so on. We tend to think about legal obligation as basic, inescapable. Doing good for people in general, by contrast, tends to be regarded as optional. We can't say that if our obligation to comply with law, to the extent that we have one, is grounded in a requirement that we do good for people in general. So that's a very important implication of understanding political obligation in terms of beneficence. And once you see it, two issues of limits immediately arise. If my duty is to benefit people, whom do I have to benefit? If we understand political obligation in terms of beneficence, can we restrict its scope to our own country, our own jurisdiction? It actually seems hard to do that. My colleague Jeremy Waldron discusses the example of the French government instructing the Secret Service agents who did this to the Greenpeace ship the Rainbow Warrior in Auckland Harbour in 1985. The French government instructed the frogmen who did this to perjure themselves in New Zealand courts. And the point of Waldron's example is to bring out an intuition, the intuition being that we have duties at least not to undermine justified legal practices in other countries. If this global duty with respect to legal practices is explained in terms of beneficence, then it follows that we have at least some obligations of beneficence to everyone, everywhere. Which brings me to the second issue of limits, that of demands. If I have a duty to promote the good everywhere, how much sacrifice am I required to sustain? Act utilitarianism, that's a theory which holds, in effect, that beneficence is all there is to morality. Act utilitarianism is maximally demanding. I am to sacrifice up to the point where further efforts would burden me more than they would benefit others. No limit, in other words. I think almost nobody over the age of 25 believes this, but it is actually difficult to describe a more reasonable duty of beneficence. Reasonable in the sense of not being obviously absurdly demanding. I myself have suggested that the issue of the demands of beneficence should be understood in terms of shared responsibility. We should understand the duty of beneficence as a collective duty, with each bound to bear the burdens that they would bear if everyone were complying. Several other suggestions have been made. For example, that sacrifice for the sake of making things go better is required up to the point where one's ability to live a minimally decent life is threatened. All suggestions, including or perhaps especially my own, are subject to objection. But I want to notice a very important fact about all possible duties of beneficence. Whether you're required to maximize the good, as act utilitarianism requires, or shoulder only your fair share of the burden, or benefit up to some fixed level of sacrifice, however the duty is specified, it seems that we will never, in fact, be in a position to know whether we have complied with it. We will never be in a position to know all the relevant facts. I'm supposed to make the world go best. How do I know what to do that? I don't have all the relevant facts. The facts in question include, of course, those concerning the effective means to the end of promoting justice or welfare or some other goods. But in any context where the problem of the one and the many is present, we also need to know facts about whether we are possibly members of some group that will together do good or harm. And on some solutions to the problem of demands, further facts are required, such as on the view I've defended, the counterfactual level of sacrifice I would have to sustain if everyone were complying. For it a duty to have any plausibility, it must be possible for it to guide our action. Ought implies can. Since we can't know all the relevant facts, compliance relative to the facts would be possible only as a matter of luck. This suggests that duties of beneficence should be understood so that we comply with them if we are complying relative to the evidence that it is reasonable to expect us to acquire. This seems headed in the right direction. Compliance now seems to be possible. I only have to comply given the evidence, or given the evidence that I reasonably should have. But the direction we're heading in is away from a perfect duty of beneficence to an imperfect one. A perfect duty, such as a duty not to assault another, tells you what to do case by case. If there are no countervailing considerations, you should not assault on no occasion. An imperfect duty, such as Kant's imperfect duty of beneficence, requires you not to act in a certain way, case by case, but to have a certain end or goal. Having a goal or end leaves to your discretion just how to fulfill or be true to it, case by case. The consequentialist tradition in ethics, which includes the various less demanding accounts of beneficence I've mentioned, recommends a perfect duty of beneficence. But as I've just noted, the only plausible way to interpret a perfect duty of beneficence such that it's actually action-guiding and we have a chance of complying with it is to relativize compliance to evidence that it's reasonable to expect a person to collect. And the introduction of this reasonableness standard introduces a role for discretion. There'll be many ways to act so that you comply relative to the evidence you reasonably should have, and it's up to you to choose among them. And if that's what the only plausible perfect duty looks like, if it has to be qualified in that way, it seems to me simpler and more accurate to say that we are actually dealing here with an imperfect duty. It is a duty to have the goal of promoting good outcomes up to some level of sacrifice, along with the goal of remaining reasonably well informed about how to achieve that goal. So my final section. I've noted that if we explain political obligation in terms of a duty of beneficence, we have to accept that the scope of the duty reaches far beyond the particular issue of legal practices. But legal practices are my focus. We should now ask specifically what an imperfect duty of beneficence, with a content that in some way responds to the issue of demands, requires of us with respect to justified legal practices. It's been clear all along that we should not harm such practices. It's hard to imagine that greater good can come from some private subject trying to undermine the legal order by trying to corrupt prosecutors or judges. But what about the question we've been trying to answer for the last half hour or so, compliance with the rules of the practices? The goal required of us by the imperfect duty of beneficence is to promote the good. Compliance with any particular legal rule relates in a very complicated way to that goal. It is difficult to assess the contribution of compliance with any discrete legal rule or in any discrete practice, such as contract law, to large goals such as justice or welfare. One of the great insights of Rawls is that legal institutions must be judged as a package, as parts of the basic structure of society. It is the basic structure as a whole that we may hope will do good. Now, that suggests that an appropriate practical orientation towards legal rules as a means to achieving some social good should not be too discriminating. Obviously, unjust laws, such as those that are obviously discriminatory or rights violating, can be recognized and left aside as a separate category. There's no moral reason to comply with them. But for the rest, including private law, mala prohibita, criminal law, and ordinary regulatory requirements, we are not in a great position to know whether compliance in fact contributes to the good or not. All that said, it surely remains the case that my individual non-compliance, considered on its own, will only rarely cause any harm. My individual non-compliance as an anonymous private citizen. However, it's harder to know when it might cause harm together with others. And so my final, very speculative suggestion is that when general compliance by others becomes less reliable, such as in the current phase of US history, where respect for law is starting to seem like a quaint, old-fashioned idea, an imperfect duty of beneficence recommends a risk-averse approach. In a situation of increasing likelihood that my compliance will make me part of a group whose joint non-compliance causes harm to justified legal practices, it seems plausible that the goal of promoting the good recommends a subsidiary goal of generally complying with all not obviously unjust legal rules. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.